Subway everyday value means many mouth-watering pile-high favorites are $5 footlongs, like the fresh-toasted tempting meatball marinara and made-to-your-order BLT. The $5 footlong anthem rolls on only at Subway, where great everyday value lives. Subway, eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, we're going to do a little NFL draft stuff today. We brought the old regulars in. Aaron Schatz coming up in a little bit on the Subway Fresh Tech Hotline right now. Our old friend from the National Football Post, Mike Lombardi, what's happening?
Not much, Bill. Just ready. Looking forward to the first primetime draft in NFL history.
Yeah, the only thing is Thursday is a great TV night. I'm not sure we needed to do this on Thursday night. Or do it like 2 weeks earlier when it's not competing against NBA and NHL playoffs. We have like five playoff games on Thursday night.
I'm sure the flipper will be in full control. I'm sure you'll have a way of going back and forth. I don't think,
Unfortunately, I'm going to be at Tribeca for the premiere of The Two Escobars. I'm going to miss one of the great sports TV nights in recent memory. Hey, the big story. Roethlisberger, does he get traded?
No, I don't think he gets traded. I think it's right now it would be a seller's, the buyer's market. And the Steelers really don't want to have this at a reduced sale. They need to have if they're going to trade Ben Roethlisberger, they need to make sure they have a chance to replace him and go through it. I think they're looking more at rehab and seeing if he'll actually turn his life around. They're going to use this as an opportunity to rearrange their locker room and get control of a player that basically they lost control of.
They already won two Super Bowls, though. You don't have maybe the same urgency that a team would have that hasn't won and will do just about anything to get that ring. And it's also one of the most unique football cities, I think. You have very blue-collar family values. Like, it's just one of those places that this whole situation doesn't really fly. I mean, if there was ever a team that was going to cut bait, wouldn't it be the Steelers?
Yeah, they certainly have the owner structure that they – everything starts from the top down in Pittsburgh, and the Rooneys clearly have established a philosophy, whether it has been when Noel was there or Bill Cowher was there or now Mike Tomlin. I mean, it is an organizational philosophy, but I also believe they feel like they've got a huge investment in Ben. They need to make sure that they get some kind of return on that investment, and also they also make sure that they can handle – the situation, and I think that's really what they're looking at. If they can't handle this situation by this happening, and I've written about this before, fear does the work of reason. At this point in Ben's life, he's fearful of his career, and I think now is the exact time the Steelers can reason with him and show him that he's got to pay attention to detail and attention on and off the field. This problem, obviously, with the woman is different, but there are similar problems that show up on the football field. Backed up against Cleveland, he gets a blitz he's seen 100 times, doesn't make the right check, gets sacked, blames it on the line. All those things are all the residual effects of his lack of preparation, his lack of respect for his teammates, for other women, for what he does in his life. And I think now the Steelers can use this as a way of creating a situation where, look, you're not this superstar. We're going to cut you back down to size, and you need to live a better life all the way around.
Well, just for the sake of argument, what's a fair value for him? Like, let's say Buffalo offered the number 9 pick and a number 2 next year. Is that a fair value for him?
You trade a young quarterback who's won two Super Bowls, who's Muhammad Ali back in the pocket, who can keep people away from him. He's hard to get on the ground. He's got those long arms. He makes throws. He can throw the ball in every weather. I think it would be very difficult to think a 1 and a 2, especially when Cutler went for the boatload that he went for. Now, I understand the circumstances are different here in terms of the off-the-field activity. That being said, that's the hard part, is putting a value on Ben that will be rewarding enough for the Steelers to make the move. That move there would really be a dump.
Well, I guess we'd have to figure out what his actual value is, because you know, obviously this hasn't affected him, his on-the-field talents, and it's not like he had a major injury or anything, but it's more a case that you have to sell it to your fans. And I guess that would come down to what fan base is desperate enough to talk themselves into a guy that really might not be that great of a guy, or, you know, or you could talk yourself into the whole, oh, it's a he said, she said thing and go that route. But, like, you know, to me, Buffalo seems like pretty desperate fan base. I think the Chiefs are in the same boat. Like, what if the Chiefs offered the number 5 pick and Matt Cassel?
Well, I think, you know, the one thing about America that's clear is people like a comeback story. And if Ben handles this well and he apologizes and does the things he has to do to get his life back in order, there's nothing more appealing to the American public than somebody who makes a comeback and overcomes obstacles of what he's done to himself. And so I think the Steelers would be better off playing that card than talking about maybe the 5th pick in the draft and taking the Chiefs pick and thinking Jimmy Clausen's the answer and going forward. I do believe the Steelers need to be proactive and make sure whether it's Dennis Dixon or some other player that they do have somebody behind them, because obviously he's going to get suspended for a significant time and they're going to need to cover their team and be able to win without him, much like if something would happen to an injury. But I really believe in this case, rehab's the better call for Pittsburgh because the value won't be the same in the open market.
If Clausen was better, is this more of an argument?
Oh, clearly, if Clausen was more of what they wanted, it would be a better argument. Yeah, but then Clausen would be the, you know, he could easily be the second pick, and somebody would be wanting the Detroit Lions pick, which nobody seems to want right now.
Yeah, I mean, if it, let's say he was like a Phil Rivers type.
There'd be more activity of people trying to trade up for him. Right now, it's very, very quiet, and it's very difficult to pinpoint where Jimmy Clausen's going to go in the draft. He could easily slip. Now, the tragedy here is Jimmy Clausen's better than Brady Quinn, although he keeps getting compared to Brady Quinn because they're both Notre Dame quarterbacks. And Jimmy Clausen's ability on the field is significantly better than Brady Quinn's was in terms of accuracy, his ball location, and the things he can do with the football in his hand.
He's one of the most polarizing QB prospects we've had, in my opinion. It just seems like people are all over the map in him. Like Todd McShay won't even acknowledge that he's a first rounder. He just refuses. Yeah. And that yet other people are in love with the guy.
And Kuiper, you know, thinks the world of him. And so there's certainly, and that's always the case. And Bill Walsh said this to me back in 1984, that very few people can evaluate the quarterback and even fewer can coach him. So all these evaluations of quarterbacks have to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt, because not a lot of people really understand the dynamics of what it takes to play quarterback. I heard somebody complaining about Florida, about Tim Tebow and his inability to read in the Florida offense. Well, to make that statement, you have to understand what he's supposed to be reading on every single play, and you'd have to really be intimately involved with the Florida offense. The person saying this clearly wasn't. So a lot of the stuff that's being said is not accurate information.
If you had the number one pick, Sam Bradford, no question?
No question, I'd pick Sam Bradford. If I'm the Rams, I haven't picked a quarterback since 67. I've got no chance at coming back. I hear all this rhetoric about trade down, getting more picks. The Rams need a blue-chip player. They don't need a bunch of more guys that aren't going to help you win. And in the NFL, it's about having a blue-chip quarterback. It's about having a blue-chip coach. It's about having a left tackle and having a defense that can rush the passer. And you can put those four things together, you got a chance to be very competitive for a long time.
Rank him, in your opinion, of the top three QBs that have been taken the last 12 years. We'll say Peyton Manning's a 10, Eli's an 8, Joey Harrington's a 4, and Jamarcus Russell's a 1.
If Eli's an 8, I think he's Eli. I think he can be a Phillip Rivers type of player. Would that Phillip Rivers being a 9, let's say? I think he's a half. I think that's where he would be. He's very accurate. He can understand what he's doing with the football. He has great ability to lead his team. I mean, if you talk to any of the Oklahoma players, they really became behind Sam. They were infected by his personality and his leadership, and I think his accuracy combined with the right skill set, his offense and his athleticism, I think will really benefit him.
So you think he's a sure thing?
Yeah, I do.
Really?
I think he's much better than Mark Sanchez coming out. I thought he would have been the first pick in the draft had he come out last year when his body really wasn't ready. I hear people say all the time, well, you know, this year off really hurt him. No, I think the year off helped him. It helped him get his body better. It helped him get his body stronger. It helped him endure the things he's going to have to endure in the first year in the NFL. And him throwing 5 touchdown passes against a really bad Missouri defense isn't going to enhance his stock any further. Last year, he had many people, including myself, thought he was going to come out in the draft, that he was going to be able, he had talked about hiring a trainer and living in Arizona, and he kind of pulled the cord. Sanchez was supposed to stay in college football last year, and Bradford was supposed to come out, and it got reversed.
Would you say that he's more of a sure thing than Tim Couch, David Carr, Alex Smith, or Russell?
Without question, yeah. I mean, each one of those instances, there was problems and there was concerns going in. Couch's arm strength, certainly playing in the shotgun, not being under center all the time, that was a concern. Carr held onto the ball way too long. He doesn't anticipate receivers coming open. It was always a concern. So those problems were there. I think Sam Bradford has proven that he can play well.
So the only concern would be his shoulder, which everybody says is fine.
Yeah, which is the same concern as what Drew Brees had, but, you know, his shoulder's fine.
Why would the Lions want to trade out of that number two spot?
Well, the only reason I could think of is because they feel like they need to recoup a few picks, and they feel like if they have two players, they can go in any direction. They can go left tackle or defensive tackle. Now, if they're able to make the Albert Haynesworth trade, which I don't believe they'll be able to do, but I think the Redskins are really dancing around this issue. They're really not talking about trade. And if they trade for Haynesworth, whatever the value of that is, which is hard to equate because he's certainly a talented player, then that would give them, that would fill their need of defensive tackle and size in the defensive line, which then would allow them to draft also Russell Okun and play Jeff Backus at left guard, and they would really repair their football team tremendously. But that being said, Haynesworth is the key to that. They need a defensive tackle. If you watched them play defense last year, they were painful. They couldn't rush the pass, so they should have made a deal with the opponent to count the five Mississippi before they rushed, because that would have been better than just watching their defensive lineman rush, because they couldn't. So they're really bad defensively, and they need all the blue-chip players they can get. So unless the situation's right, I don't really think they'll trade out of there.
I mean, if you're the Lions and you have a chance to get Sue, who's not only a sure thing but is an awesome character guy, you know,
yeah,
like one of the best, why wouldn't you just take him? What's the big deal?
I think that's clearly the pick they want to make. You know, he's a worker. He's very talented. He's very athletic. I think he's, you know, everything you should. I think a lot of teams throw these smoke screens into the air to make it look like they don't want to do something, when in reality they really will do it.
It seems like if you're going to separate this draft into tiers, it seems like the top four is pretty clear from a talent standpoint. The fourth guy would be Eric Berry, the safety. And yet, it doesn't seem like he's going to go number four. Why do we do this every year?
I don't know. That's the strange thing. I know Scott Pioli came out and said that, you know, safety wasn't something he could visualize himself drafting. And I just found that to be really the wrong approach, because when you watch the league, there's 10 quarterbacks in the NFL threw for 4,000 yards last year. So it's a passing league. If you don't have somebody in your secondary who can make plays on the ball, and really watch the New Orleans Saints, if it's not for Darren Sharper back there, they don't win as many games, they don't play that home field, and they don't get to the Super Bowl. A safety who can impact the game can impact the game. And you have to pick them wherever you have to pick them. And I think really they're making a mistake if they don't pick the safety, because I think he is one of those Ed Reed-type players who can really turn the game around, and he has great instincts on where the football is, which is what you need in the secondary, because you're not going to play great defense in the NFL any longer. The league's rules mandate you can't. So you got to play great in the red area, and you got to have a safety that reads red area well and can make plays on the ball in tight quarters, which Berry can do.
Isn't the goal just to get impact guys? How about that idea?
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good. And quick focusing on the position, because we all say, well, you can't draft a center that early. But, you know, 5 years from now, we never go back in the draft and say, you know, they picked Junior Seau three picks too early, or they picked this player two picks too early. We just say the player is a good player or not. The only day we ever value where you pick them is on draft day. After that, we value them how they're picked. And to me, that's wrong in terms of how you evaluate the draft. You should evaluate how the player plays. Don't worry about draft management as much as worrying about how good the player. If you pick a guy 14 and he turns out to be great, you think somebody's going to call you up and say, well, you should have really picked him 19?
Yeah, you would think you would just get him. And
right, it doesn't make sense. The logic doesn't prevail.
Washington has the fourth pick, though. Why wouldn't they take Berry?
I think they could move Laron Landry down to strong safety, which is where he needs to play, in the box, attacking the pocket, playing on first level and second level, and then let a guy behind him really roam the field and make plays. I think it makes a lot of sense. The other problem for Washington is they have no left tackle. If they don't draft a left tackle, I don't know how they protect the quarterback next year. It's going to be a lot of bootlegs and nakeds, because they don't have anybody in that team from across the board. Stephen Hare may be able to play a little bit in a pinch. He's better suited to play right tackle. But for the most part, they have to get a tackle.
All right, so Cleveland flips 7 to Washington for 4, and they throw in one of their thirds, and Cleveland takes Eric Berry 4. Why doesn't that happen?
Say that again.
Cleveland gives the number 7 and one of their thirds to Washington for number 4. And then the Cleveland picks
Eric Washington Berry. Washington would jump all over that pick. Washington would jump all over that trade. You know, moving up 3 spots for a 3, I think you could really get that pick for a 4 because I'm not sure anybody else is coming up to get it. And, you know, the Browns have all those picks, and I agree. It's better to get quality than quantity. I'm the believer of, especially in drafts, especially when you're as least talented as some of these teams, I take the opposite approach. Most teams that don't have a lot of talent feel like we need to collect certain players. But what you really need to do is collect a blue-chip player, and then you can find players that fit around those blue-chip players. When you have a team of a bunch of average guys, it's hard to get that one distinguishable player that makes a difference.
Yeah, I'm of the same mindset. I just think in the NFL you need like 7 or 8 warrior blue chip sure thing guys, and no matter by any rhyme or reason you got to go get them. And to me, if Eric Berry is sitting there at 4 and Washington wants to take a left tackle, then somebody's got moving in that spot. Let's go down a couple picks. It starts to get a little murky around like the 6-7 range.
Yeah, it does. I think, you know, certainly Seattle has, they're looking at combinations. Seattle's looking at, do we take C.J. Spiller-Hare and take Charles Brown with our other pick in the first round so we get a running back and a left tackle? Or do we take Brian Bulaga here and maybe take Javid Best down there where we're picking? How do we work this? Or do we take a defensive lineman down there? How do we work these scenarios out? When you have two picks like that, you want to make sure that the first pick you know you get, but you almost like a pool player, you move the cue ball back to an area where you know you're going to make the next shot, and they have to be tactical in how they approach it. So I think really that's what Seattle's going to spend most of their time working on.
And Spiller's interesting because, you know, this is such a weak running back draft at the top. He almost gets more – he almost has more value than he should. I mean, is there a danger there with, because there's so few at that position, that you start talking yourself into somebody who might not be worth taking that high?
No, because here's why I think Spiller has got value, because of the spread attacks. To be really good in a spread attack, people think and assume you need great receivers. And really what you need is a dynamic running back. The running back makes the spread attack. He's the point guard. He's the guy who really makes it go. He's the one who you have to worry about screens. You got to worry about draws. You got to worry about the zone run. You got to worry about nickel runs. And then all of a sudden, you help them do all that, and then you can throw the ball down the field because people are worried about the box and defending the box. I think part of New England's problem is they don't have anybody when they get in that spread attack that people are worried about that are going to run the ball down their throat or can make a big play. You know, we saw glimpses of it with Fred Taylor, but we clearly didn't see it with anyone else, and Maroney hasn't brought that to the table. The running back makes the spread attack. That's why C.J. Spiller is such a hot commodity.
So you think he's legitimate?
Yeah, I do. I think he's legitimate. I think he's a big play guy. And going back to, you know, everybody's looking for the next Chris Johnson, which is interesting. Do you think Tennessee gets any crap for picking Chris Johnson too soon? Because if we go back and listen to that draft day, everybody talking about, they said he picked him, you know, 20 picks too early. He was more of a second round pick. You think he is now?
So who is most likely to move up to get Spiller? Or will Seattle just take him at 6?
I think they could take him just at 6 because I think they feel like if they could get a left tackle at their next pick, you know, I think it's 13. I think that certainly they can feel like they get Charles Brown at 13, who I hear is rising up the draft board immensely, the left tackle from USC. So I think that combination would really improve Seattle's team and give them a guy that they could put in their attack that really could be a home run hitter. If they don't go in that direction, then I think they'll go offensive tackle there, Trent Williams, and then maybe Javid Best move down a little bit in where they are and pick another running back. See, Best is very similar to Spiller. The problem with him is concussions and his durability issue.
No chance the Pats move up to get Spiller, right?
Doesn't sound like it, no. I think if the Pats moved up to get anybody, it might be Dez Bryant.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Oh. You just put a hop in my step. I needed something to get excited about because I'm already resigned to the fact that this draft is going to be going. I'm going to be at some Tribeca thing. I'm going to be checking my BlackBerry, refreshing it every 20 seconds. It's going to close in on the Pats pick.
I'll text you. Don't worry. I'll keep you posted. I'll text
no,
you.
No, and then they're going to trade down is what's going to happen. I'm going to be looking forward to the pick for 2 hours, and then be like, oh, the Patriots have traded number 22 or whatever it is, and we've moved down 12 spots.
I think they're sitting in their ideal spot because I think there'll be somebody that they may want to go up and get, not that far that they'll have to go get them, and then they can – or they can stay right where they are and make a solid pick. I think your point earlier, there's 4 players in this draft, and then after those 4, there's a cluster of players. And that cluster makes trading down very difficult because you're going to get one of those players in the cluster. And the line of demarcation is where is the cluster and is the value of when you'll be able to trade down. And that's something that you have to figure out. I think Dez Bryant, there was a time I thought he would make it to 22. I don't think he makes it there now.
Is there anybody out of that cluster? Because this seems to happen every year. One guy just because whatever, teams are drafted by need, and the guy just falls five spots lower than he should. Who's that guy?
Well, it could be Dez Bryant. It could be, it could be somebody like him because I think he has the off the field issues that people are concerned about. And unless you've done your complete homework, he can be a guy that you have to worry about, or you have to, you have to make sure you've done all your homework on. I think Jason Pierre-Paul is another guy that could slip because he doesn't have enough history to him. But I think he can really be a dynamic pass rusher. The Brandon Grahams and the Mike Iupati's, those guys have been really scouted extremely well, and I think they'll certainly go to where they're supposed to go. It'll be hard to get a true value on those guys because they've been well scouted and everybody knows who they are.
Is there a chance Tebow gets taken ahead of Klassen?
I would think that to be not likely, but I do believe the teams that like Tebow probably don't like Klassen. So if Buffalo were to trade up into this first round and say get to Minnesota's pick at 30, I think they would like. I think they would prefer a Tebow over Klassen. So that could be the case. It's very difficult. There's three players I'm having a hard time putting a team with: Taylor Mays, Klassen, and then of course Tebow. But I know the teams that like Tebow, and then Dez Bryant is always difficult.
Klassen seems like if he doesn't go number 9, who the hell knows where he's going?
I don't think he's going 9. I think he's not the kind of guy. When you look at Chan Gailey's history in the NFL and in college, Clawson's not the style of quarterback that suits his style of offense.
Hold on. I'm still laughing as I look at Chan Gailey's history. Hold on. I'm not done yet. And I'm done. Okay. So if he doesn't go number 9, and you don't think he does, and I actually don't either, he could really fall to the 20s. It could be like an Aaron Rodgers kind of dip.
Right, and then at that point, the teams that need a quarterback, whether it's Cleveland at 38, whether it's Oakland at 39.
Come on, he's not going to fall that far.
No, at those teams then, because the draft being one day, those teams are not going to want to sit around and wait for a while.
Oh, okay.
I mean, here's the thing, and they're going to want to try to trade up into the 20s and get the guy. So I think that's what protects he, and I think it also protects Clawson.
Well, Pittsburgh's at 18.
There certainly could be. I'm sure they went back in the latest instances with Ben and reevaluated all their quarterbacks, and I would not be surprised if they didn't move them up around at least.
What if, can you imagine if Pittsburgh took Tebow? He's kind of like the anti-Roethlisberger.
Yeah, he is, but he's also kind of like Cordell Stewart. But remember, when Cordell Stewart was in Pittsburgh, that was when Chan Gailey was there. So
right.
That's what motivated that pick. And then, of course, when Chan was in Miami, there was Ray Lucas there. And there's always been a guy that Chan likes, Quincy Carter in Dallas. So there's always a guy like that athleticism that he likes. And when you're done laughing, that ultimately is a guy I think will be who Buffalo picks, that style of player.
That would be funny if Pittsburgh took Tebow and then said, we're doing this partially to rehabilitate Ben's character. We think he can make Ben a better person. Any major curveballs you're expecting in the second half of the first round?
I think there'll always be curveballs because, what you're going to see is tight ends might go in the first round. Cincinnati's looking at a tight end. Baltimore could use a tight end. Baltimore could still pick another receiver. I think there's certainly everybody has the needs picked, but when you're picking from about Pittsburgh 18 all the way back to 32, you really just should pick the best player and forget about your depth chart because that value is more important than filling a need at the position. So there's going to be some surprises. I think Charles Brown moving way up the board as fast as he's done is a surprise. I think Golden Tate's moving up the board. He's a receiver that people really like, and I think he's going to make a difference on some teams. So I think there's a lot of things intrigued that goes into this draft because what happens oftentimes in mock drafts is you keep giving the same names out, so everybody works with the same list of players, so you never have to give the guy that you really like away. And then, for example, a Roger Safford from Indiana, who's a good player, left tackle, right tackle, can play anywhere. All of a sudden, when he goes in the first round, people might be surprised if he went 30 or 31, but he's a guy that everybody in the league has been talking about for a long time but never put his name out there.
The most interesting kind of under-the-radar subplot to me is that Seattle and San Francisco both have two really high picks, and that's a crappy division. There's really Arizona, and that's it. And if they nail both, if either of those teams nails both of those picks, we're looking at a potential, you know, Super Bowl contender, I think. Or am I crazy?
No, I think you're right. I think if San Francisco would admit they need a quarterback, I think they could easily be a team on the right track to a Super Bowl. But they won't admit that. They think Alex Smith could be the answer, and they like David Carr, so they're not willing to go in that direction. But San Francisco has two picks that they could really enhance. They need a corner because Nate Clemens can't cover you or me, so they're going to have to pick a corner. They need a right tackle because they're having a hard time protecting. So they got to fill those two needs. If they do that, they're really a solid football team with not a lot of areas of weakness.
What do the Patriots do?
I think the Patriots pick a skilled player. They certainly need a wide receiver. They need somebody that can run routes, that can be precise in what he does. With Moss on the outside, Welker coming off the injury, Edelman's going to be a good player. But they miss, and I know this sounds completely strange, but they miss that Jabbar Gaffney type of player. And then the other position I think they need a running back to give them some juice, some substance in their backfield that people fear when they're in that spread set.
And who is that person?
Well, I think Jahvid Best would be the other guy. C.J. Spiller's a back. You know, I think Jahvid Best would be a guy that people fear, be the home run hitter, the Robert Smith type of player, as I describe it. That's the visual that I have that could make a difference for them. I think Ryan Matthews is more of a every down type of player. I think when you need a spread back, you need a guy who can hit that zone play and take it to the house.
I would love to see them get somebody like that. And I think if you look at the draft, those running backs that go late first round, second round, those seem to be the best values that you can get. Like somebody like Ray Rice, who I think was 55th.
Yeah, no, he went later and shouldn't have. I mean, Ben Tate's a guy like Ray Rice. I mean, he's going to go a little bit later than he should, and he's a really good player. You know, he does everything you want him to do, and he's very, very effective at doing it.
Because from a cap standpoint, like you pointed out earlier, you can't win the Super Bowl unless you have somebody that defenses respect at your running back. And
after.
You have to, and you can really get these guys for dirt cheap. I don't understand why anybody would ever pay big free agent money for a running back. I just think that would be the dumbest way to spend your money. Can always find these guys.
And San Diego benefited. As critical as I've been on LT, San Diego did benefit from having LT back there because there was the perception that maybe he is going to turn it around. So you still weren't sure he was done yet, you know, and so you were a little. So you still had to worry about it. And then when he couldn't do it, you backed off during the game. But going in the game, there was an instinct from most defenses that, hey, we got to stop this player. Now I'm not sure that'll happen as he's in New York, but I think you're right. When you have to worry about the back, you really opens up your passing game. And I'm not talking about we got to run the ball first. I mean, Philadelphia with LeSean McCoy and the screens and the draws and what they do, it helps their down the field passing attack.
Your favorite sleeper in the top 40?
Oh, I like Marquise Pouncey from Florida. I think he's a center, but I think he's a really good football player. I think he's going to be a guy who goes to the Pro Bowl for a long time. I think if somebody takes him in the first round, it's a smart pick. I really think that Dan Williams, a nose tackle from Tennessee, will be a really good player. I think he's a powerful guy. He can go. And I like this Jason Pierre-Paul. I think he's got unique skills. I think if he gets with the right coach and the right team, I think he can really become a great pass rusher.
All right. So you're doing NFL Network all week?
All week.
Are you going to be at the draft?
I'm texting you on Thursday, huh?
Are you at the draft?
No. I'm in L.A. for the rest of my life, I think. I'm here for a long, long time.
Oh, man. We got to redo the guest room for you.
There you go. So I'll text you. Don't worry. I'll keep you in the loop on what's happening here. We won't be on the air. They'll have it in New York, but then we'll do it afterwards.
All right.
Able to devote full time to the Common Sense Coach.
Just save a draft in your text that the Pats traded down two spot and then just leave the two numbers blank and you can send it immediately.
Now?
Yeah, just
you
say
want me to
right,
type up and save it.
Write 97% of it now and just type in the two numbers when we find out what spot is. Michael Lombardi, thanks as always. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, another one of our old friends from footballoutsiders.com. It doesn't fancy himself as a draft expert, but he does know where the holes are for some of these teams. Aaron Schatz, what's happening?
Hey, man. Yeah, I'm not really an expert on the draft. I don't watch a lot of college football. Like I often point out about Boston in college football, if it's not Doug Flutie, nobody cares.
Yeah.
And it's just a lot to learn all these new kids every year. So what I say to people is, let's find out what teams they go to, and then I'll start caring.
Right.
But I am, you know, obviously, since my focus is the NFL, half of the draft is figuring out who needs what, not just, you know, which kids are the best prospects. So
give me like a top eight. Well, actually, let's start here. Seattle has two picks in the top 15. San Francisco has two picks in the top 20. It seems like they would be the most likely candidates to get a real jump if they got two guys that were good. What do you think each of those teams should do?
Well, San Francisco is really obvious. San Francisco needs offensive linemen, which would probably not mean a big jump right away, because usually offensive linemen, you know, they take some time to learn if you're going to stick two rookies in your offensive line. But it can obviously be a very nice thing long term. Look at the Jets and what's happened to them since they added DeBrickashaw Ferguson and Nick Mangold. And their offensive line was horrible last year. In our, you know, we have the stat, the adjusted line yards that separates runs by certain distances, and they were dead last. And meanwhile, Frank Gore was second in the league behind Chris Johnson in, yards, past 10 yards, per run. So he was getting into the open field, was going crazy, but he just never got there because the line was so bad. And they also took a ton of sacks. So, you know, they just, it's such a gaping hole for them. They could definitely compete for that division title if they had a better offensive line next year.
So you're saying San Fran has 13 and 17. They could go O-line with both, and Frank Gore becomes maybe a top two fantasy pick next year.
But he'll be better. I think Frank Gore might be a top two fantasy pick in 2011 if they go O-line with two picks this year. Like I said, it takes time for guys to develop.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's usually easier for guards than it is for tackles. They took a tackle and a guard, maybe a right tackle and a guard, and have Joe Staley still playing left tackle. I mean, they could be better. We know Gore's got the talent. I mean, that's not, you know, the problem isn't him.
Yeah.
But, like, Coffey came in last year and averaged, what, like 2.5 yards a carry or something? I mean, you put an average back behind that line, and that's what happens.
Seattle has 6-14. What do they do?
Well, Seattle needs a lot of picks, players, because last year was sort of the end of the era. It was either that team was going to bounce back last year, or it was a sign that things had really collapsed for them. And I think that the winner was things have really collapsed for them, and they really need a lot. I mean, they need receiver, they need running back, they need quarterback. I'm sorry, I don't quite buy the Charlie Whitehurst thing. I mean, we'll have to see what happens, but there's no reason to believe he's going to be a starting quarterback. You know, he wasn't even the second stringer in San Diego. He was the third stringer in San Diego. They need safeties. Probably the only thing they don't need is linebackers.
Hmm. What does Washington need the most? Because they're number four.
Left tackle.
So it's just no-brainer, take the left tackle.
It's no-brainer, unless something weird happens. And I don't like these, the stuff where rumblings we're hearing out of Detroit about them taking the left tackle. I mean, as much as left tackles are great at the top of the draft, I just think that the idea of taking Ndamukong Suh and putting him in Jim Schwartz's defense to play the same role that Albert Haynesworth did in Tennessee is just so no-brainer for them.
Yeah.
And then that easily fits McCoy goes to Tampa Bay to be the next Warren Sapp, hopefully for them, and then Okung to Washington. Those four picks with Bradford going one make so much sense for those four teams that I can't imagine it not going that way.
Are you the Eric Berry, it's a top four. Lombardi and I were just talking about it. Eric Berry is like the fourth of the top four blue chippers and yet might not go four because of this wisdom that you don't take safeties that high. What do you think of that?
Well, it is wisdom because, remember, when you're looking for players, you're not looking for the best players. You're looking for the best marginal value. That's why quarterbacks go so high, even if they're not the best prospect this year. Right? For example, Bradford's not the best prospect of the year at any position. But he'll go number one because the difference between a good quarterback and a bad quarterback usually means more wins than the difference between a good defensive tackle and a bad defensive tackle. And it really means more wins than the difference between a good safety and a bad safety. Not that safeties aren't great, but for the most part, if you look at where the starters in the NFL are taken and where you get the most quality players, safety is one of the few positions where the most quality players don't come out of the first round. They actually come out of the second round. And I'm not saying don't take one in the first round, but to take one at like 5 or 6, it just seems a little high. You're more likely to get value if you take a left tackle 6 and a safety in the third round than if you take a safety 6 and a left tackle in the third round.
With that said, let's say that Eric Berry, there's a 100% chance that he's the next Ed Reed. Now what's his value?
Well, if it's a 100% chance that he's the next Ed Reed, he should go first overall.
Okay.
But nothing comes with a 100% chance.
Right.
That's not how this really works. I mean, I think he's very good. There are some teams that need safeties badly. Tampa Bay, where Savvy Piscitelli was horrible last year, completely blew coverage on a couple of 65-yard touchdowns against Dallas, missed tackles. You know, we counted missed tackles last year for the first time. He had more missed tackles on running plays than any other defender we counted. Philadelphia desperately needs a safety. Dallas desperately needs a safety. Those two teams, the holes are more glaring than they are for Tampa Bay, because Tampa Bay has a lot of problems right now, whereas Philly and Dallas, it's safety is really the biggest problem for each team. So, you know, there's some talk about Philly trying to move up, maybe, because they've got two first-round picks. If they could move up to get Barry or that guy, or Thomas out of Texas.
Yeah. Well, the teams that could get Barry, so Cleveland's, Washington's 4, Kansas City's 5, Seattle's 6, and Cleveland is 7. Seems like Cleveland would be the most logical.
Kansas City could use a safety.
Yeah. But they're like, you know, Pioli, though.
Well, he's about value.
Backwards. Yeah,
he's about value.
Well, who needs the running? Who, in your opinion, who needs a running back the most out of maybe the teams in the 5 to 13 range?
Seattle.
Yeah. So wouldn't they? Then it
they have
make
Julius
sense.
Jones and Justin Forsett. I mean, that's not really a fabulous combination there.
Seems like they should just take C.J. Spiller 6.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too weird.
Yeah,
I'll tell you the guy I like, though, if a team is willing to wait for a running back in the second round, is Brandon Tate. Auburn running backs have such a great track record.
Yeah.
And you know we have this thing we do, speed score, which is based on a guy's 40 at the combine, combined with his weight, because of the fact that, you know, a bigger back has more power. So even if he runs a little slower, he'll probably have more success in the NFL. Tate had the highest speed score this year of any player.
Really? Who had the highest one last year? Did you do it last year?
I'm trying to remember from last year. 2 years ago, it was Chris Johnson.
Yeah. I'm trying to find Brandon Tate on.
My mind is blanking as to who it was last year.
Todd McShay's has separated everybody by tiers.
A couple of the guys with really high speed scores last year got drafted really late or not at all. Aaron Brown, Giants guy in the seventh round, had the second highest score. Ian Johnson had a really high score, that guy from Boise State who's on the Minnesota practice squad.
What's the new stat that you guys came up with that you're excited about?
This is just debuted today. If people want to go to footballoutsiders.com, it's called Sack Seer. It was invented by a guy named Nate Forster. I love it when readers send me really awesome stuff like this. It is a system for projecting edge rushers, in other words, defensive ends and 3-4 outside linebackers, based on four things: vertical leap, which makes sense if you think about vertical leap is explosiveness in your legs; short shuttle run, which, you know, helps you measure, you know, maneuverability around a block; sack rate in college, modified, you know, for guys who may have played more defensive tackle or whatever; and how many games they missed in college, because that often helps you predict who's going to be injury prone or who might have trouble learning the playbook.
Huh.
Now, it's not actually the best year for edge rushers, according to this system. The best guy in the draft, according to this system, is Jerry Hughes out of Texas Christian. And his projection is only to have 28 sacks in his first 5 seasons. So that's nowhere near as good a projection as, like, you know, the top pass rushers in this system. I mean, the best projection in this system over the last decade was Aaron Schobel, followed by Mario Williams, Andre Carter, and Sean Merriman. So that's pretty good. Now, the shocking guy this year is Jason Pierre-Paul. Jason Pierre-Paul is projected to have 4 sacks in his first 5 years.
Wow.
The system hates him. First of all, the list of pass rushers with junior college experience is like a massive list of suckitude. Anton Palapoy, Eric Flowers, Michael Burrow, David Vakune. These are guys who, like, never played. I mean, Vakune was like a healthy scratch most of the year this year. He was a second-round pick of Cleveland last year. And so that Pierre-Paul's got that going against him. He didn't really have that many sacks last year for South Florida. He had a poor vertical leap, and he had a poor short shuttle time. He does bad in every single way that this thing measures a college prospects.
You're going to love this. Lombardi said that that was one of his favorite sleepers in this draft.
With Pierre-Paul?
Yeah, so now this comes down to stats versus the naked eye.
Yeah, listen, if you're going to draft this guy, you better believe that he is going to break all historical trends. And he might, because there's always somebody who does, right? But I wouldn't take that chance. I mean, you're talking about a guy. You're talking about a guy who basically had two-thirds of a season of major college football and had, and even in that, only had like 6.5 sacks. And based on that, you're going to make him a top 15 pick? It's just, you have no, I mean, it's just, you have to go back to Leonard Little in 1998 to find a guy who played junior college and ended up being a successful pass rusher in the NFL. Who's an edge guy, not, you know, Julian Peterson is, it doesn't really count because he's a 4-3 linebacker. But Little only played 1 year in junior college. He didn't play 2 years in junior college. The list of guys who played junior college, it's really just a bunch of washouts.
Here's my counter. This is the year of Pierre. We had the Pierre Bowl. Remember?
I spent like $30 on Juan Pierre in my AL Roto draft, so...
Maybe Pierre. It's a big trend in football.
It is a big Pierre, but the problem here is that that would only work if his name was Pierre Paul Jason.
That's a good point. Yeah, I guess it's middle name.
Doesn't go well with Garcon Pierre and Woods Pierre. It's the other way around.
Statistically, is there any way to figure out what QBs are going to make it?
We have the Lewin Career Forecast. That's our system that looks at guys from the first couple rounds.
Do you like it, though?
Based on college games started and completion percentage. There are some questions about it over the last couple of years. I need to do a little bit of work on it. Dave can't do work on it anymore because he now works for the Cleveland Cavaliers. So I have to be busy doing this while he's busy waiting for LeBron to win him a ring. And, obviously...
Well, what's that system, though? Explain it.
It's based on two things, which is college games started and completion percentage in college. And it's been really accurate in the past, but over the last couple of years, it's liked a couple of guys who so far have not panned out. Leinart, Brady Quinn, Brian Brome, who was a complete disaster. On the other hand, it liked Kevin Cobb. You know, it loved Philip Rivers. It loved Roethlisberger. It hated Jamarcus Russell. It's still got a pretty good track record. But I do wonder a little bit this year because it thinks that Colt McCoy is the greatest thing since sliced bread. The guy started for 4 years in college and has a completion percentage around 70%. The problem is colleges go more and more and more to the spread stuff. You're talking tons of little bubble screens. And that's just not the same. Completion percentage is just not measuring touch and accuracy in the same way. When you're talking about all those little bubble screens and stuff, that's the same problem with Tim Tebow, who also has a high completion rate and a lot of games started.
Yeah,
I will say this system says Bradford is about as sure a thing as you could get if you take a quarterback first overall. He has like Philip Rivers and Peyton Manning like projection.
It does seem like any system should incorporate win-loss record. I know it's not totally fair, but, man, you look at
the guys. It's not fair. I mean, look at Cutler. Had to play at Vanderbilt, for crying out loud. And then look at anybody who went to Miami. How are Ken Dorsey and Brock Berlin doing?
Let me throw this back at you. Look at Cutler. Not a winner in the pros.
Well, he was in Denver.
He was 500 at Denver.
Give him the Denver offensive line, he'll win again.
He's a 500 QB in the pros and sucked in Vanderbilt. Who's the other guy? Kyle Bowler? I think he was like 14 for 40.
System hates Bowler.
Yeah.
System hated Bowler. Bowler had a completion rate in college under 50%. How on earth could you draft a quarterback in the first round who couldn't even complete half his passes in college? That's ludicrous.
I think that win-loss record should matter with this stuff a little bit because, as we've found out over and over again over the years, quarterback is a position of personality and leadership.
Well, if that was true, then wouldn't Matt Leinart and Brady Quinn, especially Matt Leinart, shouldn't the system have been completely right about him?
Nobody won more
than Matt Leinart in college.
Matt Leinart is the third in the punch bowl of that theory. I'd be the first to admit. On the other hand, though, I would argue that maybe you have to apply child actor laws.
Well, listen, I still think Leinart is going to come through. They've never let him really play well. The fact is, when he was a rookie and played half a season, his numbers were reasonably good. The few games he played the next year before getting injured, his numbers were reasonably good. I remember that the crown their ass game against the Bears. He was picking apart that zone like crazy. The thing about Leinart is, if you think about watching him against a couple of different defenses, you start to notice that he destroys zones and he can't handle man because he just doesn't have, I guess, the zip on the ball to get it into the small holes in the man coverage. But he kills zone. If they could figure out how to use his intelligence, you know, and accuracy against man in the same way that they can use that stuff against zones, he could be a pretty good cornerback.
I do wonder if he became too much of a celebrity that last USC year.
Yeah, but he clearly hasn't been the last couple of years.
He got knocked down to size like a child actor. What did you think of the McNabb trade?
What did I think of the McNabb trade? It makes Washington better in the short term, but you wonder about the long term. I think that McNabb is a better bet than Cobb for 2010, but Cobb's a better bet than McNabb for 2011 and beyond.
So you like them more for Philly?
As long as you understand that it doesn't make them better this year.
But we can't rule it out.
There's a very good possibility that Washington makes the playoffs this year and Philadelphia doesn't, and everybody will look at the trade and see that it's a mistake. But that's not really where this trade is coming from. This trade is coming from, like, 2011 to 2014. And at that point, McNabb is going to be an aging guy in his mid-30s, just like everybody else Washington picks up. And assuming that Philadelphia is right about Cobb and he continues to develop past the way that he played last year, they've got now this core of offensive players where everybody is under the age of 27, and they're all going to grow up together. Celek, Macklin, McCoy, Jackson, and Cobb. So... longer term, it's good for Philly.
Didn't your system like Jason Campbell?
The system likes Jason Campbell. It doesn't love him. We've gotten in a lot of trouble for the things we've written about Jason Campbell. Because the thing about Jason Campbell is that Jason Campbell is an average NFL quarterback, and that's just not sexy. No one likes an average quarterback. You either want a guy who's really good or you want a guy who sucks so that you can make jokes about him. And the fact is that Jason Campbell is neither of those guys. So people kind of have decided that he sucks because they can't understand the concept of an average quarterback. He's like Brad Johnson, okay? You put a good team around him, he can win. That team was not good with all the offensive line problems that they had and all those wide receivers a couple of years ago in the second round, none of whom developed. Thomas, Kelly, Fred Davis, the tight end, started to get it at the end of last year. But it's not like he had a great offense around him. But he's like the 16th best quarterback in the league, and that just doesn't excite anybody.
I remember like about midway through the season, you were excited about him as a free agent steal, but then his play tailed off, I think, down the stretch.
I still think I'd be excited if he were to go to a good team that needed a quarterback.
Well, it does seem like he'd make more sense than Charlie Whitehurst, for example.
Yes.
What's Charlie Whitehurst's ceiling? Is he going to be better than Jason Campbell? Like, I don't even know.
Nobody even knows where the ceiling is.
Yeah.
The guy hasn't played.
Yeah.
The guy was a third-round pick who has been sitting on the bench for 4 years. Nobody has any clue. I like his hair and all, but, you know, I mean, nobody has any idea how good he's going to be.
As a Patriots fan, explain what it was like to have Pete Carroll as your coach.
Well, I'll be honest. Pete Carroll was designed to coach college football.
Yes.
I happen to think the same about Herman Edwards.
Yes.
His rah-rah, go-get-em attitude just works a lot better with college kids than it does with, you know, kind of jaded pros who have to go home to their wives and children.
And you know where else it works? You know where else it works? In the living room of the parents of the high school
recruits. Oh, God, can you imagine? I mean, yeah. That's why I keep saying Herm Edwards. You send Herm Edwards around to every prospect's house to have dinner with mom, and I swear to God, every player is going to go to that school.
Yes.
But I happen to think that the biggest problem with the Patriots in the 97 to 99 period was not Pete Carroll, it was Bobby Greer.
Yeah, well, they combo didn't help.
As much as Pete Carroll as coach frustrated you because his attitude just didn't seem to fit, not just the NFL, but the idea of coaching an East Coast team with the way East Coast fans are, the bigger problem was that Bobby Greer was buying the groceries and was terrible at it.
Although, one of those picks remains on the team, Mr. Kevin Falk.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, nobody's like, you know, even Matt Millen has reasonable picks every so often. You know, it's not all garbage.
I don't see, have you guys ever done a study of the college coaches coming to the pros? Because it just feels like this fails all the time.
I don't think we've ever done a straight-out study of it. It does feel like, what I don't understand is bringing college coaches in and giving them full power.
Yeah.
Because what it takes to manage a college program when it comes to recruiting and what it takes to manage a professional program when it comes to scouting and free agency and cap management is so fundamentally different. It's not that the idea of Pete Carroll being an NFL coach again is absurd after the success he's had in college. It's that the idea of him being an NFL general manager and team president is absurd. And the same went for giving Saban all the power in Miami. It just doesn't, that part doesn't make sense to me.
I would argue that both are absurd. I don't think that you can be out of the NFL for 10 years and come back in. And that is such a competitive disadvantage, in my opinion.
Well, it worked for Dick Vermeil.
But what was he doing, though, announcing?
He was a college football announcer. He was a college football broadcaster.
Okay, so it's worked once. But it hasn't worked how many times? Spurrier,
well, I mean,
Petrino.
Listen, also the fact is that Carroll doesn't have the best record as a head coach in the NFL.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I question the move for that reason, too. But he makes a lot more sense as a coach than he does as a team president.
Yeah, it's too bad they didn't do the combo. What do you expect from Shanahan in Denver?
In Washington, you mean?
I mean, I'm sorry, in Washington.
Honestly, I think they'll be a little bit better next year. There's just a lot of trends overall that suggest that they'll be better that have nothing to do with Shanahan or Bruce Allen. But, you know, you have the don't drive 55 theory about head coaches.
Yeah.
And we did research and found that it actually exists, although we found that the limit's about 57, that coaches begin to decline after they hit about the age of 57. And you are talking about a guy here who's, you know, teams didn't do quite as well in his last couple years. And now he's going to a new team, and he's a little older. I think the interesting thing is the draft, because neither Shanahan nor Bruce Allen is a draft expert. Shanahan's forte is on-the-field coaching. Allen's forte is salary cap management, which is what Washington really needed, but neither of them is a great draft, is known for having great drafts. But, I don't think Shanahan's going to be the savior. There's also the problem of it's the best division in football. All four of those teams are legitimate playoff contenders.
I know you can't really do it without knowing who got who in the draft, but have you run any stuff for who's looking fantastic for next year and who's not looking fantastic?
No, I'm still playing around. I'm still playing around with the projection systems. After last year where things didn't – last year was the first year where our projections were pretty off on defense. I want to make sure things are really good and really improved before I spit out any names of teams.
Have you recovered from Bill Polian discounting any statistical revolution in football at the Sloan Conference?
Yeah, I think I'm okay.
Okay. You were mad that day.
I was really angry that day, man. But on the other hand, I mean, some of the stuff Cuban said in that panel is really good because it backs up some of the stuff I've said about the NFL. Because he talked at that panel about how he wishes the NBA would just put more information in the public data, because if every team had it, then it wouldn't be about a race to get data. It would be about who understood data the best and who was the smartest. And I wish football was that way, too. It just seems like teams are hesitant to share anything with any other team. But, if the play-by-play had more data in it, no team would be at a disadvantage if every team had data. And if the public had data, too, that would kind of really be really nice.
Who do you think are, like, the top four teams that are really using this stuff?
San Francisco, Philadelphia, New England, I'm not sure who else would be quite that high, but I mean, I know that Baltimore's done stuff. I know that I'm sure Kansas City is because of Paoli being there. I had a guy from Dallas tell me that they read my stuff. There are
seems
a lot
like
of
it's slow.
Stuff. Not
it's
open.
Going slow.
Well, the problem is not that it's going slow. It's that people in the NFL are so quiet that they'll never tell you what they're doing. For all I know, there are teams that read everything we write religiously and thinks it's the greatest thing ever. Or there are teams that are 5 or 6 years past anything we're doing, but they're never going to tell you. So you don't know.
But in baseball, the teams just started cherry-picking all these guys.
Yeah, and in basketball, too. John Hollinger is the only basketball guy who doesn't work for a team now.
All right, so we'll talk to you over the summer as soon as you finish crunching.
Absolutely, absolutely. It definitely becomes a lot easier to look at what's going to happen in the season once these guys actually get distributed to NFL teams and we're not all just sitting here blabbering on about, well, they could go here, they could go here, they could go here, they could go here. And all that talk that we've had for the last couple months becomes meaningless Saturday afternoon when everybody gets distributed.
Aaron Schatz, footballoutsiders.com. Thank you.
Be well, man.
Joe Mead, you have 2 minutes to tell us what you think the Buffalo Bills should do.
Trade out of the first round.
Trade down. Wow.
Trade down.
At a number 9?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like first round picks. You pay too much for what you get. I mean, I think the Patriots are the model for what to do with first round picks.
Would you trade down and then take a QB?
Sure. I mean, I'd rather trade like a third round pick to the Redskins for Jason Campbell.
Look at you. You're like going cap on me. I like it. Like
absolutely.
Little caponomics.
You can't spend a first round pick on a quarterback. I mean, you know, you might get Peyton Manning, but you might get Ryan Leaf, and then you're done.
Well, you're preaching in the choir. I would not take Sam Bradford first.
I mean, I love Ndamukong Suh. He's a great guy. If the Bills could get him, you know, if they could trade up just a few spots, like if he's going to slide to four.
That's not happening.
And you could get him. I mean, sure. So if they can trade up to two and take him, but I don't want to take a quarterback that high. You can get other quarterbacks for much less later on.
If the Bills ended up taking Tebow, how would that change your relationship with God?
Well, of course, it would positively influence. I'd start drinking the Tebow Kool-Aid pretty fast.
You would be. I think you'd have the jersey by mid-June.
I'm never going to retire the Lossman jersey.
What number would he wear? I forget what number he wore at Florida.
I don't know. Well,
what was Jim Kelly's number?
12.
So as long as it's not 12, you're happy.
Sure.
Because I don't think he'd want to change his number. He picked that number for a specific reason, whatever it is. God told him to pick the number.
Indeed.
Good luck.
I like Tebow, but hopefully they don't take him at pick number 9. If they get him in the second round, let's go for it.
So you don't get swept up in the whole Buffalo Sabres thing? There's no spillover for you?
What do you mean? I'm following the Sabres. I'm upset about that hit on Thomas Vanek by whatever that jerk on the Bruins is.
Oh.
Sent him out for game 3. He's probably done for the series.
It's not my fault the guy couldn't stay in the ice.
Anyway, the Sabres should take care of the Bruins tonight, and I may go to the game on Wednesday.
Look at you.
Yeah
the Sabres, it's one of those few franchises where you feel bad when your team's playing them because you know all the pain their fans have been through.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, we win, but this will really legitimately ruin everybody's sports life in Buffalo for 6 months until the Bills start playing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just happy the Sabres are back in the playoffs after missing it for a few years.
Great uniforms.
Yeah.
And really good home crowds. I think the playoffs have been really fun. I've tried to watch a lot of it. But
I feel like the Buffalo Sabres crowds are like those Golden State Warriors crowds.
Yeah.
So
the Canucks are like that, too. The Canucks fans really brought it. There's been some good ones. A lot of teams that you can tell it's been a while since they've been in Lima.
Indeed. And with the Sabres, you know, when you have the best goalie in the world with Ryan Miller, you always have a chance.
He's pretty good. American hero. All right. BS Report coming back tomorrow. Until then.
Target the channel. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
With all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just breaking news. Subway now has breakfast. And unlike the competition, you can get it made just the way you want. Like the Subway Western Egg White Muffin Melt. Add jalapenos, banana peppers, tomatoes, or try Monterey Cheddar. Build your better breakfast at Subway. And after you build your better breakfast, grab your favorite $5 footlong to go. Made to your order all day, every day. Only at Subway.